Dios bendiga a los argentinos. Muchas gracias.
That was Argentinian president-elect Javier Milei in his victory speech on Sunday saying, "Long live Argentina, damn it." Milei, who had Make Argentina Great Again slogans on the campaign trail, has been compared repeatedly to Donald Trump because he's a far-right populist with no government experience, but also because of his strongman rhetoric and his penchant for conspiracy theories. Trump congratulated Milei on his victory. Meanwhile, Trump has been increasingly veering into even more vengeful autocratic speech, such as this moment in New Hampshire on Veterans Day.
We pledge to you that we will root out the communists, Marxists, fascists, and the radical left thugs that live like vermin within the confines of our country.
Historians say Trump's rhetoric increasingly echoes autocrats of the past and are sounding the alarm for what a second Trump presidency could bring. Joining me now is Ruth Ben-Ghiat, professor of history at New York University and author of the book Strongmen, Mussolini to the Present. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, when you hear that speech that he gave on Veterans Day, especially with that word vermin, that is a loaded term, what do you think?
When I hear that speech and the reference to rooting out, leftists, et cetera, who live like vermin in the confines of our nation, my mind goes back to the original fascists. That's the way they talked. And we have to always ask, why is Trump doing this and why now? And, since 2015, Trump has been using his campaign events to and all public proclamations to shift the way that Americans see violence, to make it into something that might be necessary to save the nation and even patriotic, which we saw with January 6th. Now he's escalating because he's also, on top of this, he's dehumanizing his targets. And the purpose of this is to get people psychologically prepared for the repression that he and his Trump 2025 team are openly announcing.
Now, he also said in that speech, our threat is from within. Who are the targets? Who does he see as the number one threat?
Yeah, this is like, Trump is in my book, which goes from Mussolini to up to today's today's authoritarians. And it's like seeing a chapter come to life. Again, because these are kind of right-wing counter-revolutions. And what you do in a right-wing counter-revolution is you declare war, not so much on foreign enemies, but on your own people. And you use the military, paramilitaries, et cetera, to root out, confine, deport, all the repressive measures, but you're using them on people in your own country. And this was the other thing that was so disturbing about that speech. And it goes back to the original fascism, which came out of World War I, but then Hitler and Mussolini and Franco turned their troops and their squadrons and their militias on their own people.
Mm. So who does he see within the country as the biggest threat, as the first group that he would attack?
So we can, he's been talking about immigrants, and this mm-hmm. goes back to, of course, to his first term, and saying that they're polluting the blood of the nation. This also aligns with great replacement theory, the idea that immigrants are coming in and non-white immigrants and who are kind of outproducing demographically white people, so they're going to extinguish the white race. And this is very popular among Trump and Republicans. It's no longer just a fringe theory. So immigrants, but who he mentions are, radical leftists, who I guess include, all kinds of people, because now with polarization, there's no center, it's always radical leftists. And they're broad categories of people. And the point that if anyone thinks, I'm not a radical leftist, I'm not going to be touched by Trump, so I don't have to care, that's not how it works. If you look at the history of authoritarianism, there are always people who think they're not going to be bothered, and so they can support them. And then the roster of enemies always expands with these kinds of leaders, and they find out too late that they too have become targets.
Mm. But what do you say to people who say, look, Trump is a clown. He has repeatedly said these things and he repeatedly does not struck a chord with the majority of Americans, that most people, when you look at the vote count, voted for his opponents in the past two elections. So what do you say to that, that it's a lot of steam? He's riling up one section of the electorate, but is by no means the majority of Americans.
It doesn't have to be the majority of the Americans, because authoritarian takeovers from Mussolini and Hitler, who were invited in by a handful of people to take power, they don't have to represent the will of the people. Indeed, they're there to subvert the will of the people. And so as to Trump being a clown, I don't find anything clownish about January 6th. And most Americans perhaps don't realize how close we came to losing our democracy on that day, and how close lawmakers of both parties came to losing their lives. And a third of my book is about coups. And so I take these things very seriously. I advised the January 6th committee on Trump's violence rhetoric. And so we don't want to assume that he's just words, because he's already proven with his actions that he intends to use violent methods on his own people to get to power and to stay there.
Mm-hmm. And of course, he is one person, but he definitely has the Republican Party behind him. Maybe in private, Republican leaders are murmuring about all of this and not in favor of the way he speaks or of him in general. And yet they have not said anything publicly. Nobody came out, I think, amongst the Republican leadership to condemn the Vermin speech. So when you look at the history of collaborators and collusion, what do you see now in terms of Republican leadership?
Sadly, the GOP is an entirely captured party. What I'm using the word captured is autocratic capture. They have been thoroughly domesticated. They are thoroughly submissive to Trump. And we need only to remember this scene, which I will never forget as somebody who studies authoritarianism. The first GOP debate, all of the people running against him, supposedly, for the presidency, all but two of them raised their hands when they were asked, would they support Trump even if he were a convicted felon? And so they were performing a ritual that is only understandable in terms of authoritarian dynamics. They were undercutting their own power and humiliating themselves. They are candidates running against him. And yet they said that, no, they will vote for leader Trump, even if he's a convicted criminal. This kind of sums up where the party is today, and why we right now, they are have arranged themselves in the tradition of history's biggest enablers of authoritarians.
Do you anticipate another January 6th type expression of violence in the 2024 election?
I think that if Trump did not win the election, he and his associates have studied very carefully what didn't work. So these are people who are very intent on getting back to power. Trump himself, as per the authoritarian playbook, is compelled to get back to power and make all of his legal troubles go away. That's why so many authoritarian style people run for office while they're under investigation or have indictments, things that other types of politicians don't do. So there's no telling what he would do if he loses, but he would not just submit to the results, because he's also invested years of rhetoric about our elections as untrustworthy. Mm-hmm. And that has been to prepare for occasions such as this. It worked very well in 2020. And now he has doubled down on this, and he's got all of the GOP, including the new Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, to parrot his propaganda. The last thing that's happening is you see Tommy Tuberville, the senator, and Michael Flynn starting to talk about that we shouldn't have elections. We don't need elections. So that's where it's headed, and which is a thoroughly authoritarian thing to say.
Wow. Ruth Ben-Ghiat, professor of history at NYU and author of the book Strong Man, Mussolini to the Present. Thanks for coming back on the show.
It's a pleasure.
Coming up, how to not have a conversation about Trump this Thanksgiving. Advice for a stress-free holiday gathering next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It is officially the holiday season, and many say it's the most wonderful time of year. Many others think, oh, no, it's stressful. I have to be with my family. Well, we are going to talk about what to do to avoid potential minefields at the Thanksgiving table with Maria Meir. She's a licensed marriage and family therapist in California. Hello.
Hi, Madeline. How are you doing?
Good. Well, I think there is the expectation, or at least the hope, that this year will be different, that it will be fun and peaceful and there will be no arguments at the Thanksgiving table. Should we hold on to that fantasy?
You know, that is just a fantasy, because of course there's always going to be some type of conflict when you bring everybody together. And people haven't been together in a long time. You know, people are meeting up post-COVID. So it's a big family reunion this year.
Right. So let's talk about some strategies to avoid conflict. And what are some of the top reasons that lead to conflict?
I think just getting a lot of different personalities together. You know, all families have, you know, their fair share of issues, and they go way back. So sometimes when you see people, things are triggered, you know, and things aren't really resolved from deep within, right? Mm-hmm. So whatever was our normal growing up, you know, we were kind of in our family, we kind of did our thing, it was normal, it was fine. But as adults, we go back to the family, you learn that, hey, I didn't really like that part. And now there's a conflict there.
Right. And now I'm an adult, and now I don't have to stand for it. And I'm going to say something. Is that the general feeling?
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to say something, or I'm not going to say something. And you can just feel that in the room.
Do you think people should say something, or save it for later? Or don't save it for later. Don't say it all.
No, I'm a big believer in communication and resolving things, you know? So it always takes two to communicate, but I always say save it for a time when, you know, you're meant to actually communicate about the issue. Thanksgiving, holidays, probably not the best time to kind of bring up something that's really deep. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what I would say is, you know, perhaps like you have to kind of assess your own boundaries and what you're comfortable with before going to, you know, your family gatherings. You know, are you comfortable with seeing certain family members for an extended period of time? If not, like, keep your trip short, you know, keep it to where it's pleasant, keep it to surface level. Already imagine all the scenarios, all the questions they're going to ask you. If you're single, when are you getting married? If you're married, when's the baby? If you have one baby, when's the second? All of those questions that might irritate you. Imagine all the different scenarios, and just kind of be prepared, you know, and assess your comfortability, you know, stay at your boundaries, keep your wall up if you have to, but just keep it pleasant for the time being.
Well, what if you're the host and you can't leave?
Well, if you're the host, then you can't leave, you know, keep your dinner from a certain time.
And actually kick people out at the end?
Yeah, like, well, you could always say like, okay, we're going to have dinner from this time to this time, you know, because we're going to go Black Friday shopping. I mean, there's an excuse or something. Or, you know, just try to like start winding it down. And if you're the host and you can't leave, you got to also assess your own boundaries. Maybe already have conversations in mind that if a topic, you know, goes to something that you don't want to talk about, you already throw something back at that person mm-hmm. that you are comfortable talking about.
I imagine a lot of people want to talk about politics and what's going on in the world, maybe the war in Israel. What's your advice about that?
Yeah, between, I mean, Palestine and Israel, like, no matter what side you're on, I think at this point, you know, when you want to talk about politics and it may come up, you know, I would say, you know, keep politics at the door. But what you can take from that situation is, no matter what, I mean, Thanksgiving is a time for gratitude and, you know, to be so grateful and thankful for just having, you know, safety and food and shelter and family and, you know, all of these things that, you know, instead of like arguing what side you're on, kind of like take that moment and just, you know, bring it to the table and be thankful.
Mm-hmm. Right. What about activities? Is that a good way to kind of ease the tension, like word games or, I don't know, playing a video game or something like that?
Yes, I love activities. And I think that's like actually a really good idea for when families, like, you don't have to be stuck having conversations. And if you don't want to be the one that, you know, brings the games or thinks of games ideas, because when people are together and you're having fun and you're playing games, there you go. You're not talking about something that's too deep, but you're still having that family bonding time, and it's fun and everyone's laughing, and it's a great way to spend time together and avoiding things that you don't want to talk about.
Okay. And so I guess there's also the grief situation as well. Maybe someone's lost a family member or a friend or something like that. Like, how do you deal with that?
I think, you know, holidays and events are really hard, especially if it's the first year, you know, everything is really fresh and, you know, you feel really sad, of course, like, you know, that person is no longer there. But I think it's a good idea to still remember that person in whatever way that you would celebrate together, you know, and take some time, you know, either if you do it, if this is something that you want to even do alone before coming to Thanksgiving and you need to kind of have that time alone, I would say celebrate that person, take that time to remember that person. And if you do it as a family, I would say, like, however you want to do it, like if you want to take turns talking about that person, or if there's something that you want to do, just a moment, a prayer or something mm-hmm. like that. However you want to celebrate that person or remember that person, you know, I think just take that moment and do it.
Yeah. And how do you celebrate it? Do you celebrate it with your family, with friends? How do you make it a pleasant occasion?
I have a big family. So like my cousins, everybody, we grew up like brother and sister. So we all kind of get together, we potluck and, you know, we celebrate. This year, everyone's kind of traveling, doing their own thing. There's a new baby in the family that people are visiting out of state. So everyone's kind of everywhere. So this year, I'm going to keep it small, just with my immediate family. And I really didn't want to cook for just five people, honestly. So what I did was I got a meal from a restaurant, and, you know, we're going to do it that way. But we like to set the table, you know, go around saying what we're thankful for and kind of just being together and, you know, enjoying the day off. And then, of course, you know, we got to go shopping.
Okay. It's a whole other can of worms. All right. Well, yeah. That sounds lovely. Maria Meir, licensed marriage and family therapist here in Southern California. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Happy Thanksgiving.
You too. Coming up, we'll have your weekend movie reviews, including the latest Ridley Scott epic, Napoleon.
It almost played more like a comedy, and I'm not sure that was the intent, because it's very funny, but I'm not sure it's supposed to be.
That's next on Press Play. You're listening to KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Time now for your weekend film reviews. This week, we have a Ridley Scott epic, a sequel to the teen comedy Good Burger, 26 years after the original. And Disney continues its holiday tradition of releasing a new animated feature around Thanksgiving. Sean Edwards is here to talk about these movies, and he is an award-winning journalist for Fox 4 News in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Sean.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thanks. Also joining us, William Bibbiani, film critic and co-host of the critically acclaimed network. Hi, Bibbs.
Hi, I've won no awards.
Congratulations. All right, let's start with Napoleon from director Ridley Scott. Joaquin Phoenix plays the title character.
No doubt you've seen the chaos in the streets. We must make an example, or France will fall.
What would you do if this assignment of defense was transferred to you?
I promise you brilliant successes. I'm the first to admit when I make a mistake. I simply never do.
Okay, Sean, this is the origin story for Napoleon, and it's also a romance because there's a lot in this about his relationship with Josephine, his wife, played by Vanessa Kirby. Tell us more.
Yeah, it is. It's a look or an attempt at the look at the military commander's swift rise to power, his climb to become emperor. It's also viewed through sort of this prism of his like addictive and volatile relationship that he has with his wife, his true love, Josephine, and it's directed by Ridley Scott. It's an impressive film from a craftsmanship perspective. I mean, it looks great. It sounds great. It looks authentic to the period. The problem with the film is there's a huge imbalance that exists with Napoleon, because how can a film this big and this grand say so very little and not explain enough? Now, like I said, the battle scenes are terrific, but everything else is sort of this mix of half facts and incorrect historical depictions. And I mean, there's no doubt Joaquin Phoenix is a terrific actor, but he sort of lazily traverses the material. Not sure that's all his fault. You can maybe lay some of that blame on director Ridley Scott. But the thing that I found most interesting with the film is it almost played more like a comedy. And I'm not sure that was the intent, because it's very funny, but I'm not sure it's supposed to be.
Ooh, it doesn't look like it's supposed to be, because in the preview, in the trailers, Joaquin Phoenix looks very, very serious. Bibbs, this was, as I understand it, Stanley Kubrick's White Whale. He really wanted to make this movie and didn't. So how does Ridley Scott stack up in your mind?
Well, I mean, that's a tall order, isn't it? And also, Napoleon has been a fascination of filmmakers since the silent era. You know, he's a gigantic historical figure and demands a gigantic historical movie. And the scale of this movie, the actual production design, the costume design, the sets, everything is very impressively staged. And yet, on the other hand, and I agree with Sean that the movie feels very eclectic and not very well formed. I think we're at a point now where maybe whenever Ridley Scott makes a movie like this, we all agree just to ignore it until the director's cut comes out, because this happens constantly. He'll make a movie, whether it's Blade Runner or Legend or Kingdom of Heaven, and it's all like, oh, this is kind of interesting visually, but it's not that great. And then the director's cut comes out and you're like, oh, this is actually a masterpiece. And why don't they just let him release the director's cut in the first place? I don't know for a fact that that's true, but this has all the earmarks of that. This sort of strange, inconsistent pacing, the sort of episodic nature of it, the elements that feel a little unexplored. It's a rather entertaining watch, and I actually think it is intentionally funny. Some of the things that Joaquin Phoenix says and does in this movie are clearly laugh lines, and the movie plays them as laugh lines. And I appreciate that in trying to capture the grand sweep of Napoleon, they're also getting the moments where he comes across as immature or insecure. And I think that really adds to the appeal of the movie. But if you're looking for a gigantic historical epic in the old-fashioned, you know, Cleopatra mold, this is a good watch and it's worth seeing in a theater. But if you're looking for something that's like a fully coherent, excellent piece of filmmaking, it's a little lackluster.
Okay, Napoleon in theaters in wide release. Next, the latest animated film from Disney. It's called Wish, and it stars Ariana DeBose as a young girl named Asha who wishes on a star and gets more than she bargained for.
Once upon a time stood Rosas, a most magical kingdom, founded by a king with the power to grant wishes.
People give their wishes to me, and I grant the wishes I am sure are good for Rosas.
Some of these will never be granted.
Not some, most.
Okay, Bibbs, this also stars Chris Pine as the handsome king. Of course, there's a handsome king. What is this movie about?
This movie is about the Disney Corporation, very explicitly. It's been 100 years since Disney got into the business of making animation with his original Alice in Wonderland shorts. And they decided to celebrate by doing this movie. And it's full of Easter eggs for various Disney films past. You know, there's the apple from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Oh, there's the horse from Tangled. Isn't that sweet? But the actual plot of the movie is about the leader of a magic kingdom who has built his empire on collecting the ideas and creations, turning the intellectual concepts of people into property, intellectual property, if you will, collecting them, hoarding them, and then leaving the people who gave them the intellectual property empty and soulless. And it's about a young woman who discovers just how corrupt and evil it is to hoard intellectual property and decides to give all the intellectual property back into the domain of the public. It is literally astounding that this movie, which unfortunately isn't particularly good, the songs are pretty forgettable, the animation style is kind of unremarkable, the cast is strong, Chris Pine and Aria DeBose in particular are really good, but it's astounding that they decided to celebrate 100 years of Disney with a movie that denounces what Disney has become very openly in the plot. It's fascinating, and I wonder if this is a complete lack of self-awareness or if this is a confession. It's hard to say.
Maybe it's the result of the strike. They're feeling a little self-hating. Okay. Sean, what did you think?
Yeah, I kind of agree with Bibbs. This sort of felt like a TED Talk lecture. In terms of animated feature, it felt like this movie had been sitting in the Disney vault for the past three decades because it felt very 90-ish. It really had that feel. Whether it's intentional or not, I don't know. It all seemed very flat. And like the biggest sin in the movie is the songs. The songs are just flat out terrible. There's no magic to the songs. They're not poppy. They're not catchy. They're not memorable. The movie just kind of like meanders along. And, you know, Ariana DeBose is fantastic, but I don't feel like she was given permission to soar. I mean, Chris Pine is a terrific actor. He had very little to do. It's a very stock character. It's a very stock story. And I don't even know who this movie's for because it's not cute enough to really appeal to kids, but yet it's not intelligent enough to really keep adults' attention.
Oh, okay. Wish in theaters in wide release. Maybe we wish it were a better movie. Next up, Maestro, about the long relationship between Leonard Bernstein, the celebrated composer and conductor, and his wife, Felicia, played by Carey Mulligan. This is, of course, starring Bradley Cooper, who co-wrote and also directed Maestro.
Hello, I'm Lenny.
Hello, Felicia.
I love people so much that it's hard for me to be alone. That music, it keeps me glued to life.
All right, Sean, there's been a lot of talk about the prosthetics that Bradley Cooper used in this. But what did you think about the movie, The Substance?
Yeah, push the conversation about prosthetics aside.
Yeah.
This is a really terrific movie. And the first thing you really need to know about Maestro is it isn't a traditional biopic, but it is a engaging and poignant look at different aspects of the life of Leonard Bernstein. And it's also a movie that plays more like a love story and an examination of his relationship with his wife than anything else. It's directed by Bradley Cooper. It stars Bradley Cooper. He's actually terrific in the movie. However, it's Carey Mulligan who functions as the heart and soul of this film. I mean, she is just flat out terrific. But I got to go back to the filmmaking. I liked a lot of the choices that Bradley Cooper made with sort of the angles and the way that he brings the film to life and his choices of doing some of the film in color and some aspects of the film in black and white. As he tells what is pretty much a complicated story about a very complicated person who has these extreme personalities that you have to sort of wrangle with as the viewer. And I love the honesty and the filmmaker in the fact that Bradley Cooper sort of lets the story breathe. And I really appreciated that with Bradley Cooper's directorial style with this film to kind of just let the story exist and let the viewer kind of like lend their own judgment to how they felt about this very complicated individual as it spans several decades of his life.
And Bibbs, does he play Bernstein convincingly? Is he the guy? Do you think, okay, this is the conductor? I mean, it's kind of impossible to do that because he was a genius, but what do you think?
Is he convincing? I think he's actually very convincing. And I'm really, there are decisions that were made in the course of making this movie that I think warrant some criticism. You could argue that the nose is distracting. And Carey Mulligan, as absolutely brilliant as she is in this movie, casting her as a Costa Rican Chilean woman was a choice. The performances are excellent across the board. And I agree with Sean. I think the thing that's really astounding about Bradley Cooper is he's an excellent actor. He's very convincing. But he has really pushed himself as a director. Between this and A Star is Born, he is an impressive storyteller who makes interesting choices. But I do think it starts really leeching out the energy of itself and ultimately ends not as strong as it begins. But that first half of the movie is really quite astounding, and it's certainly worth checking out, and it's certainly fascinating, and I think conversations should be had about the movie on a variety of topics from a variety of perspectives.
Maestro in select theaters today and on Netflix beginning December 20th. Up next, another film about an American composer. This is a documentary from Matthew Heineman. It follows a year in the life of musician John Batiste and his partner, Salika Jawad. It's called American Symphony.
The most honored artist this year with 11 nominations is Mr. John Batiste, right there.
I feel like we're living a life of contrasts.
Why? What do you mean?
It's just a lot.
I'm always in awe of Zuleika, how she deals with hardship.
My first day of chemo, his 11 Grammy nominations were announced.
Okay, Bibbs, tell us more about this couple and this movie.
Okay, so John Batiste is a musician. You may recall that in addition to winning a whole bunch of Grammys, he was also Stephen Colbert's band leader for a while on The Tonight Show. And he's married to Salika Jawad, who is also a best-selling author, an artist, who has dealt with and battled leukemia for a large part of her life. This movie, which comes from director Matthew Heineman, Oscar-nominated filmmaker, has won a bunch of Emmys, is about this really tumultuous year where, on one hand, everything is going really well for them. They get married, he wins awards, he conducts this really ambitious and exciting symphony, but also she's going back into chemo and they don't know if she's going to survive. A lot of ups and downs, both in their lives and for the audience, and it's a really fascinating watch. These are very lovable people, as depicted in the documentary, and you really do get swept up in the strange giganticness of their lives. The music is really, really wonderful. The people involved are absolutely fascinating. I mean, look, parts of it are very sad, but it's also quite joyous, and I enjoyed it immensely.
Sean, did you?
Yeah, I enjoyed it tremendously because I think the thing about it is it's the unknown aspects that happen during the film that really give it its warmth and give it its depth, because You go in expecting this to be a concert film, and it turns out to be this love story, but it's a love story full of challenges and full of struggles. But throughout it all, there's also there's a lot of hope and a lot of joy. And of course, it's a given that the music's going to be terrific because he's an incredible composer and an incredible talent. But the way that it unfolds is so unexpected that I think it gives the film a lot of unexpected energy and a lot of unexpected joy. And there's a musical rhythm to it, but there's also a rhythm of life to the film, which really sets it in motion and helps you to keep your attention as you follow these two people that have this great relationship and great chemistry together. As you go on this journey that you think is going to be about preparation for this amazing concert, and turns out to be this whole other thing about struggling with the unknown and keeping it together through adversity.
American Symphony in select theaters this Friday and on Netflix beginning November 29th. Last up, we have something for the 90s kids out there. Good Burger 2, as in a sequel. Here's a clip.
Welcome to Good Burger, home of the Good Burger. Can I take your order? Buckle up! The new adventures of Ed and Dex starts now!
All right, Bibbs, you saw this solo. What did you think?
Boy, did I. Okay, so Good Burger, for those who may not have been around in the 1990s, All That was a sketch comedy series on Nickelodeon that starred Kel Mitchell and Kenan Thompson, who is now the longest-running Saturday Night Live cast member in history. That was their original sketch comedy show, and Good Burger was their signature sketch. And that turned into a movie in 1997, which was mildly successful, but over the last couple of decades has developed a really big cult following. It's got a really sweet, interesting, bizarre sense of humor. Good Burger 2 is an odd animal because it reunites the cast, those who are still around. And yet, even though it's been over 20 years, they have decided to keep the exact same very child-friendly tone. The humor in this movie is very innocent and very silly, which is bizarre in a way, because the target demographic for this movie is surely people who remember Good Burger and remember All That, and they've grown up. Children, I hope, will see this movie because I think it will appeal to them. It's really quite adorable, but I don't think they have anything connected to the brand. So I feel like the people who should be watching this movie are people who grew up with all that and Kanan and Kel in the 90s, who have the free time this weekend to get in their jammies, sit in front of the TV, like really, really close to it, and like get like a bowl of Apple Jacks, which, sorry, parents, did taste like apples. The point is that I feel like this is a movie for adults to like just sort of win them over and remind them what it was like to be a child. Listen, Good Burger 2, it's an innocent film and it's quite cute. And if you're a fan of Good Burger, which is really the only people who this is made for, I think it's worth watching if you get in that mindset that the film has not grown up with you.
Sean, did Bib sell you on it?
He sold me not so much with the film.
But with the Apple Jacks.
Apple Jacks, yes.
I knew it. Good Burger 2, currently streaming on Paramount Plus. Sean Edwards is an award-winning journalist for Fox 4 News in Kansas City, Missouri. William Bibbiani, film critic and co-host of the critically acclaimed network. Happy Thanksgiving and happy Apple Jacksing.
Yes, thank you.
Bye.
So much.
Coming up, Evan Kleiman is here with some local food shopping ideas that do not involve Apple Jacks. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lunch?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15-minute bake-off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bit like that.
Pie.
Well, there are some big shopping days coming up after Thanksgiving. You'll find some good deals on Black Friday and Cyber Monday, of course. But if spending on Small Business Saturday is more your thing, Evan Kleiman is here with some ideas for local businesses to support. She is, of course, the host of the local radio show, KCRW's Good Food. Hello.
And now worldwide via podcast.
Exactly. You're everywhere. Okay, so we did this last year, and you gave us some great ideas. So we're going to have a list of those. We're just going to link last year's great ideas, right?
Yeah, because they continue to still be, good ideas.
Right. They're not like these businesses didn't go away all of a sudden in a year. So we will link to that at kcrw.com. But you have some new ideas this year, and they are in two categories. What are they?
One is to support local artisans directly through pop-ups or their websites or brick and mortars. And the other way is to patronize local stores that carry a whole lot of different things. You know, one of the pleasures of being a store owner is curating whatever you choose to sell. And it's always really fun and interesting to go into small, independently run stores and browse.
It is. I love it. And you get to get out of your house, which is a treat. I will say that. All right. Before we do that, though, we have to fuel up. And you have a recommendation for that.
I always think about the holiday season, which we're kicking off this week with Thanksgiving. And I think about how there's a lot of gathering at home, like wrapping presents. There's getting together before you go out and hit the stores in groups. And so I've come up with an idea to fuel you to shop so you can get some energy.
It's not just cookies, is what you're saying.
No way. We need protein.
That would be my go-to. But
no, not me.
Yeah, we do.
Not me. I need like food, savory food. And the Joint Eatery, which specializes in dry-aged seafood, sell these incredible hand-roll kits. And I recently had some friends over after I came back from being away. I ordered the hand-roll kit from the Joint, and it was just unbelievable. I mean, truly, just so much fun and so delicious.
So you're basically making your own sushi.
You're making your own hand rolls. They supply you with amazing, delicious fish, many different types, and also, you know, crab salad. They give you all of the accoutrements to season your hand rolls the way you want, and then they give you really beautiful nori to wrap it all up. So I laid it all out on the table, and we just had so much fun.
Okay, so that sounds really fun. I don't know if I'd want to leave after that. But anyway, off we go shopping. And let's go over your list of local shops to support.
So first up on my list is Carla's Fresh Market. If you're looking for a few fun condiments or special ingredients to gift your friend who's kitchen obsessed, I recommend going to Carla's and browsing the shelves. So, you know, whatever you're looking for, special olive oil, locally produced, unique sauces, take your pick.
Okay, Carla's Fresh Market. And where is it?
So Carla's Fresh Market is in Highland Park.
Moving on to Sarah's Market.
Yeah, so Sarah's Market in City Terrace is a stalwart, family-owned for 60 years. It's really great combination of what the neighborhood needs, you know? Like you go in for toilet paper and you walk out with little jars of stuff from Sunset Cultures. So they also have a really fabulous curated section of locally made products, and they also host food pop-ups, which will be quite prevalent during the holidays. So stop in, maybe eat a little something, and then just walk up and down the shelves.
Because you see all of these things that you want to take home with you. Okay, moving westward to Venice, the General Store.
I mean, the General Store has to be like the quintessential California casual boho place to browse. Really beautiful gifts from local makers and beyond. I'm partial to the mugs from Oregon ceramicist Katie Von Lehman. They're really substantial to look at, but really comfortable to hold, which is my favorite kind of mug for that friend who lingers over coffee or tea. Mm-hmm. But the in-store experience at their Beverly Boulevard store is about much more than dinnerware. It's just tabletop on steroids, from beautiful linens to glassware to even a singular bronze espresso cup by LA artist Nancy Pierce. Heath is always a peak browsing experience.
Okay, great. Heath Ceramics and the General Store for peak browsing. And there are a couple of pop-ups happening you want to mention.
It seems like ceramics are really having like such a major heyday in the past few years. And sometimes,
so true.
I mean, it's really amazing. And sometimes ceramic studios put on their own pop-ups. A really beautiful one, high level, is the Green and Bisque Clay House out in Pasadena, I believe. Pasadena, maybe Altadena. It's a holiday market filled with work of really talented local ceramicists. So the next pop-up I'm suggesting you go to is taking place at the Craft Contemporary on Wilshire near LACMA, which used to be known as the Craft and Folk Art Museum. A really OG place, and it becomes a marketplace for 2 days in December. I love that you can meet the artists or makers for special insight to that gift that you're wondering if you should buy.
All right, so getting back to food, you have brought two butter suggestions today.
Oh, yeah.
For as a present?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, would you give somebody a high-end Kraft gianduja, a.k.a. Nutella, but on steroids? Of course you would. And just like you would do that.
I would. I'm just sort of afraid it would go bad or melt or something.
No, this isn't butter like cow butter. These are, one is a rooted fair crunchy black sesame butter. So think of it more as like a peanut butter, but not. But more.
Oh, okay. So, but black sesame, not peanut.
Exactly. Slather it on toast or ice cream, eat it with a spoon, or use it in your baking. Really special. And for the holidays, they also have a pineapple cake cashew butter, which is creamy and full of sweet tart pineapple flavor.
Oh my gosh, it sounds like dessert.
It is dessert.
It's like a spoonful of it would be dessert, like an ice cream or something.
Well, I think it would be really great on ice cream. Mm-hmm. It's like a sweet, savory hit of something delicious that you would normally never buy yourself, which is why you're going to give it as a gift.
Well, a gift to yourself, maybe. All right, what else?
So I also love Corky's Nuts Walnut Butter. Corky's is a family ranch in the Capay Valley in Northern California. They grow walnuts, and it's really interesting. You go into your website, you can actually now pre-order different varieties of walnuts, which I find really interesting. They grow two different varieties. One that's more mild, so for walnut newbies, I love that you can do that. But they also make this walnut butter, which is kind of rich, buttery, and just a touch of sweet. I eat it on toast with jam, but I also love using it in the Iranian walnut pomegranate stew, fesanjan.
I've never had walnut butter, which seems weird because there's, it seems like every nut has its butter.
Exactly.
All right. So both of those, the Corky's Nuts Walnut Butter and Rooted Fair Crunchy Black Sesame Butter, need to be ordered online?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, with some of these local makers, you can usually find their goods in some of these local stores that we've talked about. But if you really, really, really want to get it, you don't want to miss it, yes, you can always order it online. And since we're doing a lot of shopping online, I want to suggest another LA local artist, Claire Crespo. I just am such a fan of her work. I love her work. I love her cookbooks that she's written over the years for children and people who love children. And her calendar every year is always really exuberant and fun. And this year, it is all about cake. And so it's these postage size sheets that you hang on your wall. She gives you a little bracket to hang it up. And there are these just fantastical cakes.
You have just hit my sweet spot, no pun intended, because cake is my favorite piece of food.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a great celebration, and they're so beautiful. They're like a design statement.
All right, that's Claire Crespo. And I would like to note that she is having a pop-up with, guess what, a ceramicist on December 9th, Heather Levine Ceramics and Claire Crespo. They have worked together to design some mushroom-inspired goods. I think they're candlesticks and things like that.
Yeah, mushrooms and insects and all of Claire's just sort of fanciful style of illustration now on ceramics, which is really fun.
Yeah, so that's going to be at Mandarin Plaza in Chinatown on December 9th. Check out the full list at kcrw.com. Evan Kleinman is host of KCRW's Good Food, and you can listen Saturday mornings at 10. Subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter at kcrw.com/goodfood. And speaking of, what is on Good Food this week?
I'm talking to the producers of High in the Hog about the great stories about African-American history in America as it relates to food culture, which is, of course, deep and rich. The second season of the Netflix series premieres this week. We also take a second look at some past interviews we love, a conversation with Paulo Orozco of Sunset Cultures, who I mentioned before, who makes just unbelievable jams and kombucha locally. We talk to the screenwriters of The Menu and get some good advice on how to curb food waste. Good conversation for this time of excess.
Aha, very good. Okay, of course, must listen radio, must listen podcast. Saturday mornings at 10, wherever you get your podcasts. Evan Kleinman, host of KCRW's Good Food. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that does it for this week on Press Play. I am thankful for our producers, Brian Hardzinski, Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, and Sarah Singer Schiff. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Amy Taw, our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney, our fabulous managing producer. And our technical director is the ever super Mario Saavedra. We also had engineering help from Sue Margulies. Do not forget to check out Evan Kleinman's local gift guide at kcrw.com, where you can also download and subscribe to our podcast, the Press Play Podcast. Tomorrow, tune in for handpicked music from KCRW DJs, KCRW's Eclectic 24. It's also electric. We'll keep you company while you cook, while you eat, while you entertain. Left, Right, and Center is here Friday at noon and 7. Okay, that's all the business I have for you. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening today. Have a happy and safe Thanksgiving. I'll be back with you on Monday.